brought to you by the Small Business Payments Alliance. According to a new survey, an overwhelming majority of small business owners oppose additional government regulations on the electronic payment system, as called for in the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. Don't let Durbin-Marshall pile new mandates on Main Street small businesses. Learn more at smallbusinesspaymentsalliance.com.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to another edition of Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on the Nerdcast, President Donald Trump heads to the border as the partial government shutdown nears the start of its fourth week. We're going to unpack the three unilateral ways that President Donald Trump might try to get his wall. Plus, is Beto O'Rourke a candidate in waiting for 2020? He lost his Texas Senate race. He's talking about a solo road trip across the country. He spent the morning Instagram living a trip to the dentist.
So I'm here at the dentist.
Talking to his hygienist about growing up in El Paso. What does it all mean?
Diana's going to tell us a little bit about growing up in El Paso.
Actually, we're going to talk about the role that digital organizing is playing in this nascent 2020 campaign and how O'Rourke fits into that and how the organizing that he did while he was running for Senate in Texas set him up for a potential presidential bid. It's going to be a really good talk. As always, we're taping this a little bit before noon Eastern on Thursday. Today, that's January the 10th, so it's all up to date as of then. Who knows who else O'Rourke is going to Instagram live with today after we tape. But anyway, let's get started. Our first data point, 1.2 billion, perhaps I should say. That's $1.2 billion. That's the overall economic cost of the partial government shutdown each week, according to the president's chief economist. So we're going to talk about that shutdown and some of the what's starting to look like the likely paths out of it with White House reporter Nancy Cook. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, welcome. So, Nancy, take us behind the scenes at the White House this week as they've tried to figure out how to sell the American public on the government shutdown. When we talked to you last week, we talked a lot about how basically nothing was happening. And that totally changed this week, but it doesn't seem like it has changed the fundamental underlying reasons for the shutdown or opened up a path out.
Yeah, so what's happened this week is that the White House has become much more aggressive in trying to make the shutdown go in their favor. And so we saw that starting early in the week. Vice President Pence and DHS Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen sat down with reporters, which, you know, they don't always do. So they sat down with reporters and spoke on the record. Trump gave this primetime address on Tuesday night in which he laid out the argument that there was this humanitarian crisis at the border. Most immigration experts say that that is not true. But he was really making that case, and he did so in sort of stark and violent terms, talking about human trafficking and the number of people who have been killed by illegal immigrants, facts that people thought that he wildly exaggerated. And then today he's going to McAllen, Texas, which is right on the border in the Rio Grande Valley, and he is going to have a briefing there, meet with some Border Patrol folks, and there is a wall slated to be built in that area in the coming months. And so we assume that part of the visit will be touring that. And so the White House really has been taking a much more aggressive messaging stance this week. And partly it's like a PR thing. They want to try to convince Americans that there is this immigration crisis and this border wall is totally needed. But also what I've been told is that they're also laying the groundwork for to take potential unilateral action. So they're trying to lay down the legal argument in case the president does something like declare a national state of emergency, which would allow him to secure this money for the border wall without going through Congress.
I want to jump back to that in a minute, but what's driving this change in strategy? Is it a recognition or a thought by the White House that they're losing the public relations battle, that people are blaming Trump more so than Democrats in Congress? Is it a thought that Trump is seen as weak because he's not able to get this thing that he's been talking about for so long? Or is it something else entirely?
So there's a few factors at play. One, I think that this is the start of a trend that we'll see throughout 2019 in which the White House staff and folks around Trump are just letting him be even Trumpier than he has been in the past. There's a sense that there's no point in trying to manage him. You've got to let him do what he wants. And what he wants is a border wall, because he sees that as a key campaign promise for 2020. Two people in the White House are very nervous about the shutdown at this point. I would say there's been a real change in their attitude privately in the last week since we last spoke. And they're very nervous. You know, polling shows that Americans are blaming Trump, not the Republicans and not the Democrats, increasingly for the shutdown. I mean, Trump himself has said he's owned it, but the American people are holding him responsible. And then third, the White House is very worried that Republicans on the Hill are going to start to defect, and they're not going to support Trump. They're not going to back him up. They're going to eventually go over and vote with Democrats to reopen these parts of the federal government that have closed. And that's been a huge part of the messaging this week. It hasn't just been to the general public. It's been to Republicans on the Hill.
It's striking to that this is all happening. And again, we've talked in previous episodes about how even just a couple days after the midterm elections, if you looked at the news, it was like the midterms had never happened, right? It was all about Jeff Sessions getting fired and so on and so forth. But we just had midterm elections where Republicans lost 40 House seats after Trump spent all of October dialing up the rhetoric and the pressure and making immigration and a border wall the central part of this. Like,
what's so interesting to me is we had 2 years of 100% Republican-controlled government. Republicans controlled the White House, the House, and the Senate. That would have been a great time to get funding for the border wall, because Republicans controlled everything. And the White House wasn't able to do it then. And so now the—
Now, that's partly because of the 60-vote threshold in the Senate, right? And
sure.
Democrats had an element of control because of that.
Exactly.
But it never got pushed to this point.
It never got pushed to this point. And now here we are in the era of divided government. Like, it's only a week old, actually. And now the government is partially shut down over this. And so, you know, I think that there's some disappointment among some Republicans that it's coming up now. And I think Republicans are really worried about taking the heat. I mean, we've seen Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell basically go dark on us. And he's, you know, normally a sort of a key deal maker. And so folks in the White House, I would say, are getting very, very nervous.
I want to now jump back to what you said before about the whole sequence of events that we've seen over the past week, and the president's public communications all seems to be setting the ball rolling for an emergency declaration, right? And a setting up a situation where he would be able to get the money without having it appropriated through Congress. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that would work? And the various issues that would arise as a result of that coming to pass. There would be legal challenges, I'm sure. There would potentially be congressional investigations.
Sure. So, I mean, just this morning, as President Trump was getting on Marine One, his helicopter, to go to Andrews Air Force Base to fly to Texas, he basically said he was asked about declaring a national emergency, and he said, you know, he said that he probably definitely would do it. And so it seems like that is the path that's headed, because it seems like that's the only way out of the shutdown. And when I talk to people in the White House, it seems like that's how it's going to go.
And when you say the only way out of the shutdown, the only way that without him having to give up.
Right. Well, last night, for instance, so Wednesday night, Jared Kushner, senior advisor to the White House, the president's son-in-law, and Shahira Knight, who is the White House congressional liaison, met with some Republicans on the Hill. I've heard some mixed things about what Kushner has been offering, but they basically work to try to come up with some sort of deal before this trip. And, you know, I've heard DACA has been on the table. Do you know what I mean? They've just been trying to see what could we give Democrats that would make them give us a little bit of money for the border wall that would be appealing to Trump. But no deal was reached. And so now it seems like increasingly the way out of the shutdown is going to be Trump is going to declare some sort of national emergency. It's going to go to the courts immediately, and it's going to get blocked. But that would allow Trump to basically say, look, I tried, and these activist judges screwed me over. So mm-hmm. It gives him sort of a way to save face and have a talking point that he can use on the campaign trail.
And when you say immediately, we're talking in court terms, right? And so it would potentially, you know, give the opportunity for some sort of government funding to get signed and implemented, and the government to reopen, and then the court would be, oh, by the way, this key part of the deal
And so the Republicans and Democrats would pass a spending bill to reopen the federal government while the court was figuring this out. But people in the White House largely think the courts would block this. And so there's sort of three ways that the president could do this, as I've talked to Republicans close to the White House and lawyers. One is that he could declare a national state of emergency, which would allow him to tap, emergency funds. But part of that is making the argument that this is a national security crisis. That's why we've seen him talk about it in these terms this week. Another option would be to tap some money through the Army Corps of Engineers for disaster relief. And we're seeing, interestingly, some Army Corps of Engineers people and the Secretary of the Army going down to Texas with Trump today. So that's another possibility. And then another possibility is tapping some money from the Department of Defense. This was brought up when Mattis was still here and is one of the reasons that Mattis quit, among others. But would be tapping that money. Law enforcement can basically say, oh, we need this money to the Department of Defense, and they would give it to them. And so sort of there's three different legal ways that Trump could do this unilaterally. And White House lawyers have basically been working around the clock this week to try to figure out how can we build the case to do this legally? And also, is this something we want to do? Because there is a real worry, even from some conservatives, that this would be a huge overreach of presidential power if he took this step.
And I assume part of what the White House lawyers are trying to figure out is which, if any, of those three avenues would be least susceptible to potentially getting blocked by court.
Exactly. And I had one Republican White House advisor tell me this week that, you know, part of the visit to the border today, you know, initially that was conceived of as a photo op, but now it's becoming part of the legal strategy. You know, the president can go down there and meet with people and get a briefing. And it's another data point that lawyers can say, well, this is part of the reason that we did this. But, you know, I just want to make one more point. You know, the White House top attorney, Pat Cipollone, he has been in the White House for 4.5 weeks.
Right.
Welcome, Pat. And so, you know, he is a very well-respected lawyer, you know, came from private practice, but worked at the Department of Justice under George W. Bush. I think he's well-liked. He doesn't have a real bomb-thrower personality, I've been told. But it's interesting to me, you know, he's just getting his sort of feet wet. He's just getting up to speed there. He just hired all these new lawyers whose job it is to largely deal with all the oversight investigations. And that's really kind of what they've been thinking through. Meanwhile, they've also suddenly been having to think through the legality of getting the president out of this government shutdown.
Nancy, you know, before the Oval Office address this week, before the trip to the border, more Americans blame Trump for the shutdown than Democrats in Congress. So that's according to Politico's Morning Consult poll that's out recently. So we'll see if any of the events of this week change that. And if it forces some sort of compromise, or if we do end up careening down this national emergency path and see what happens in the courts.
I just want to say one more thing. Tomorrow, Friday, January 11th, is the first day that federal workers will miss a paycheck. Mm-hmm. And I think that is going to bring a lot more heat to the White House because, you know, you think of federal workers in the Washington, D.C. area as making six figures. A lot of them do. But the average federal worker paycheck is $500 a week. And so that's, you know, people are going to feel the pain. And I think those stories will start to come out. And that's going to put a lot more pressure on the White House, too.
Yeah, we've already seen some stuff about air traffic controllers, TSA, so on and so forth. All right. We'll keep an eye on that. Nancy, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We are going to leave that behind and jump into our next data point, which is 700,000. And that is the number, 700,000 people, and that's a conservative estimate, who made at least one donation to Beto O'Rourke's failed Senate campaign in Texas last quarter. When I say failed, I barely failed, but still failed. That's according to Federal Election Commission data from Act Blue, the Democratic fundraising platform. And get this, at least four other Democrats talked about as potential 2020 presidential candidates racked up at least 200,000 online donors over the past 2 years, again, according to that ActBlue data. We've got two political reporters and a political editor here to help us put that in some context. On the line, we have David Siders, national political reporter, who's been reporting this week on Beto O'Rourke's presidential ambitions. Hi, David.
Hi.
We have in the studio another national political reporter, Elena Schneider, who's crunched the numbers on all the FEC data. Hi, Elena.
Hey, Scott.
And, of course, as always, senior politics editor Charlie Mutessian is here. Hello, Charlie.
Hello, Scott.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me here.
David, I want to start with your reporting on Beto O'Rourke. It seems like he's a candidate in waiting, albeit one who is acting much differently than any candidate in waiting we've seen before or currently or and possibly in the future.
Yeah, I think it's pretty bizarre how he's going about this. you know, the friends close to him, Democrats who are talking to him and to his advisors say that he's leaning towards running, and I think he probably will, but the way in which he's setting this up is certainly different. He's not responding to invitations from Iowa or New Hampshire. He's not sending a lot of signals. I think, you know, he is setting up this a kind of much different narrative from other candidates that I think he thinks will benefit him. And it's this almost kind of religious story that you can see him putting together, which is, he comes off a campaign that many Democrats saw as heroic against Ted Cruz. Now he goes into this period of, you know, a hermitage, really, where he grows a beard and he starts reflecting, occasionally talking on Facebook, as he did the other day about immigration. And then this road trip that he may go on solo, that I guess would count. That'd be the Odyssey, right? He goes on some road trip of exploration for a couple of weeks, and then by the time he makes an announcement, it's the return to a public gathering. At that point, you'd expect him to probably shave.
Is that the first time the word hermitage has ever appeared on Kiskot?
We'll have to do a transcript search, but it may well be also Odyssey. I'm loving that. This is such an interesting story, but David, I'm curious for your thought about some of this. What's going into this? It strikes my armchair analysis of this is that he's going through the process of, unlike every other presidential candidate who's trying to pave the road that they want to drive down when they launch their campaigns. It seems like the road is laid out for him, but he's going through the process of deciding if he actually wants to be president or if he would want that.
Yeah, well, according to people who talk with him, he does want to be president, and I think is leaning towards running. It's almost I guess you could call it an aloofness in one sense, that he thinks he can do it differently, be a different kind of candidate, and there are certainly a heck of a lot of pitfalls. You start to annoy Democratic activists in Iowa and New Hampshire, maybe that doesn't serve you so well. I think from his perspective, the thinking is to do something different helps to separate him from a candidate field of 624 Democrats. And to be fair, these things he's doing, we're interested in them and people are covering them. And so he has kind of capitalized, I think, on this element of the tease.
Absolutely. Now, Elena, I think one of the reasons that O'Rourke has ended up being such a big part of discussions in 2020 is how close his Senate campaign came to beating Ted Cruz in Texas in 2018, but also the way in which he did that, the massive online fundraising capacity he reached, the massive organizing potential that he showed in a Senate campaign and could take national. And you wrote a story this weekend looking at this through the lens of online fundraising, because we get actual measurable numbers on that. And you found some interesting things, not just about O'Rourke, but about a handful of other people who could be top contenders in 2020.
Right. So I think that the online numbers that we saw come out of Beto O'Rourke's Senate campaign is also factors into his timeline and factors into his ability to sit back and wait and sort of use, as Sider said, the art of the tease to keep us interested, but isn't bound by the same rules that these other candidates are in needing to go out and raise a lot of money, because he has this grassroots army that dumped,
80 million dollars in total.
$80 million total, and then something like 38, 40 million in just a single quarter, right, to find Q3, which again, that's like three presidential races in one that he was able to pull off in that Texas Senate race. So he's not bound sort of by this need to get out early and start fundraising in sort of the traditional ways, because he has this army that's already built, and it was built recently. And I think that is an important distinction, because, you know, these are also people who supported Bernie and Elizabeth Warren in previous lifetimes, but their newest, shiniest object is Beto, and he can sort of more comfortably rely on him, on them, than even maybe Warren or Sanders could.
Now, while O'Rourke was building this online army for his Senate run in 2018, there were others who were really going to great lengths to build up this capacity to raise money online, to organize online, probably with more of an eye on 2020, looking past 2018. Who are the other top contenders who, like O'Rourke, have shown they can mint money online, they can organize people online, and that could be a big asset in over the next year of the Democratic primary?
Well, I think the two most obvious examples through both FEC data and also conversations with their campaigns were Kirsten Gillibrand of New York and Kamala Harris of California. So Kirsten ran for re-election in 2018, but did not air a single TV ad throughout the entire race. Granted, it was a pretty non-competitive race, but nonetheless, it's pretty striking when you don't air a single ad. Instead, she dumped half of her campaign budget into a digital firm that is there trying to build this army for her with small dollar donors. Same thing for Kamala, who was not up for re-election this year, and yet still spent north of $1 million just on Facebook ads trying to develop a following online so that those people, it's sort of building the kindling and building sort of the firewood that you can then, when you sort of hit a viral moment, can light that match, and all of a sudden you've just, you know, created this massive fire, and that sort of can
so
propel
many
you forward.
So great metaphors on the Nerdcast this week. This is fantastic. And then, of course, on top of them, you've got Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who, as you said, Gillibrand and Harris went to great lengths to kind of build this up, and to transform their campaign operations into ones that had this tool in the box. Whereas Sanders and Warren came on this as they were running for office in past years. Sanders in 2016, Warren when she was first running for Senate in 2012. Charlie, this seems like it has the potential to radically transform aspects of the way a presidential primary goes, right? This crowdfunding, and not just the crowdfunding, the digital organizing and bringing people in from the get-go from all across the country into these movements.
Yeah, I mean, it already has. I mean, we've seen it at the House and Senate level, but we also saw it at the presidential level in 2016 with Bernie Sanders. I mean, he's the one who really provided the blueprint for how it would work, and it sustained him long past when the Democratic establishment wanted him to leave because he just had so much money. He had enough money to keep going as long as he wanted to. But I think that's not the only money-related aspect that's going to transform the Democratic primary. I think the other part is not just the logistical or mechanical side that we're talking about here in terms of raising online money and building the infrastructure to raise money and reach out and organize. It's also the debate over campaign finance.
That's a great point.
Is going to transform the Democratic primary, because when did we ever have a presidential primary where people cared about campaign finance? I mean, you know, throughout my whole career, at least, I can't think of a race that was ever decided at any level on campaign finance.
John McCain tried to make it happen, I guess, but it didn't work.
Yeah, I mean, it's just not something that in the past, and even now to a certain extent, drives voters to the polls. It's not an animating issue. Yet all of a sudden, it is, you know, up there in the pantheon of issues that are rate very high in the Democratic issue agenda. And you're already seeing that discussion take place in the Democratic primary in terms of Democrats having with proposals to restrict the influence of money on the process, and also the kind of holier-than-thou primary amongst the campaigns about where do you get your money? Do you get it online? Do you get it from small donors? Are you taking corporate money? Will there be a super PAC? And those kinds of questions we really didn't spend much time exploring in past presidential primaries.
Well, I think it's obvious that some of these candidates, like Elizabeth Warren, who came out swinging against self-funders and came out against you know, anyone having any kind of super PAC money support, that she sees that as a wedge issue. She sees that as a way to stand out in the crowd, in the same way that Beto O'Rourke sees sort of his pilgrimage into the desert as another way to stand out from the crowd. So I think that, you know, it's sort of both of interest to the activist, but also sort of really well aligns with how she wants to stand out in this crowd. But I, you know, it was interesting talking to all kinds of digital consultants for this story, because, you know, there are some cautionary tales about relying too heavily on just small dollar donors, because the moment you lose momentum, that money just disappears. So it's maybe not as reliable of a source at all times if you can't maintain momentum. And all these candidates are not going to be able to maintain momentum. And I think that the billion-dollar question is, you know, what are these small-dollar donors going to do? Are they going to keep donating to one person? Are they going to donate to five of them? Or are they going to wait? And nobody really knows that yet.
That's really a great point, because that means that for many of these campaigns, it's going to rely on them creating moments, creating viral moments and flashpoints during the campaign. And that is going to take some practice and some artificiality because, you know, when they're flagging, when they need the injection of cash, they're going to need to have their Mad Al moment or the video that catches fire or whatever. Otherwise, they're going to be dead in the water. And that's a great point because it's something that we need to sort of watch as the campaign progresses and cover that as closely as anything on the money agenda.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's going to end up being a pressure for a lot of candidates. Sanders didn't have to do this in 2016, but to find like a good hybrid that you know where they're getting enough from grassroots donors to fuel their campaigns, but also like not get hit over the head for being corporate funded or whatever, but also getting enough from bigger donors to also keep the lights on if things aren't going as well online for a few weeks. David, I'm particularly interested in your your perspective on Kamala Harris's attempt to transform her campaign operation into one that is fueled at least in big part by online money, because that having come up through California politics as the attorney general and then run for Senate, that wasn't her model, but that's also really not a model that anyone has successfully been able to do in California politics before, with speaking of, you know, big campaigns where you have to raise and spend a lot of money.
Right. No, the entire model is different in California. So that is interesting to see a Californian try to change that. The campaigning model is different too. There's no retail politics in California. You just run TV ads. And that will, you know, we'll see that in the primary, but at least in Iowa and New Hampshire and these other early states, she has to change the way she campaigns. But I think you know, the this year started, or even last year, she just spent a ton of money building email lists and really trying to nurture that list. You saw her, I think, be pretty judicious during the midterm elections about how often she would lend out that list, very protective of building it. And I think she has a pretty strong digital operation now to be able to compete. You know, I thought it was so interesting, this idea that people have to maintain momentum with these lists. I guess the inverse of that is you talk to some of these lesser candidates or not top tier candidates who the idea of momentum for them means that they can hang around in the race longer, because the idea that, you know, maybe not today, maybe not next month, but heck, maybe in October or November, something could happen that would light a spark for them. It lends this hope, I think, to a lot of candidates who might otherwise, in a more traditional fundraising universe, really see that they don't have prospects right from the outset.
Mm-hmm. But then, you know, if they get to a point where they hang around long enough that they catch fire, like Rick Santorum did in the 2012 Republican primary, or eventually Sanders did in 2016, that if they have the infrastructure built at that moment, then all of a sudden it's, you know, all systems go.
Yeah. Or even crazier than that, they look at, you know, O'Rourke and they say, well, we don't need to have any infrastructure. We don't need to have anything. We just need to have a YouTube moment. And if it comes, then I'll find somebody who knows how to place TV ads.
but the other aspect of this, though, is to have those moments to generate that kind of money. The essential ingredient is authenticity. I mean, you just can't create it. O'Rourke, I think, was able to sort of raise gobs of money was because there was an authenticity to his campaign. And it was the same thing about Bernie. No matter how you feel about Bernie or the Bernie Bros or the campaign or whatever, there was an authenticity to his message that really fueled that campaign and fueled the online donations. And I don't know that is a very easy thing to create.
I agree with that. It's not a very easy thing to create. The great thing about it, though, is that it's easy to measure, and that's something we're going to be looking into a lot over the next year as a key indicator of who has momentum. And it's going to be another kind of key piece, along with polls, which are going to bounce around a lot, and you know, media mentions or what have you, that we should all be keeping very close track of through 2019. That was excellent, you guys. Thank you so much for being here. Elena, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
David, thanks for jumping on the phone.
Thank you.
And
David,
Charlie?
I have to ask, no Wild Kingdom moments this week? No dogs tweeting songbirds in the backyard? What's going on out there?
Well, it's a pretty calm day in California.
Charlie, thank you as always.
Thank you, Scott.
And a big thank you to all of you, our listeners, for tuning in this week. Our producer is Micaela Rodriguez. Dave Shaw is our executive producer. Our illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like the Nerdcast and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show. Once again, thank you so much for tuning in. We'll talk to you again next week.